Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Today is Wednesday, November 28, 2012. I begin by noting that date because we are at this moment watching events unfold rapidly in Egypt. As our informed listeners probably know, the current president of Egypt, Mohamed Morsi, recently issued a declaration that would allow a new constitution to be drafted without interference from the Egyptian judiciary. Many observers, both within Egypt and internationally, have viewed this as a threat to the democratic integrity of the new regime. In essence, there are fears that Morsi and his close political allies in the Muslim Brotherhood will be able to determine the future rules of the political game and stack them in their favor. This declaration has set off a new round of protests within Egypt and has once again raised questions about just how democratic the Arab Spring is or will become. While there are many topics that we could address related to current events in Egypt and the Arab Spring, we will focus today on the issue of religious liberty. That issue is of great concern to many religious minorities in North Africa and the Middle East, as there are concerns that the Arab Spring may be opening the door to more Islamist governments intent on imposing Sharia law and restricting the rights of groups such as the Coptic Christians. We will explore that topic as well as the issue of whether or not religious freedom should play a role in U.S. foreign policy when it comes to dealing with these new governments. My guest today, Dr. William Inboden, knows a great deal about this topic as he served on the State Department's policy planning staff and was a senior director for strategic planning at the National Security Council. He is now an associate scholar with the Religious Freedom Project at Georgetown University's Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. And although his connections with the federal government in Georgetown would make it seem that he is a resident of Washington, D.C., he currently calls Texas his home as he is both a distinguished scholar at the Strauss Center for International Security and an assistant professor in the LBJ School of Public Affairs, both of which are housed at the University of Texas in Austin. Will, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. It's great to be with you.
Hey, back in spring of this past year, you were involved in a symposium at Georgetown's Berkeley Center that was entitled Religious Freedom and Religious Extremism, Lessons from the Arab Spring. There was a document that was related to that, and we'll link that up for our listeners who want to check that out. But that gathering had a number of really some top-notch scholars as well as some high-ranking officials from both the Bush and Obama administrations, such as Dennis Ross, Stephen Hadley, and Elliot Abrams. These are folks who have been instrumental in crafting our foreign policy towards the Middle East and other parts of the world. And it was really interesting to see them discussing the topic of religious freedom, because that's an issue that often really goes unnoticed by a lot of policymakers.
Yeah, it was very exciting to be a part of that panel. We were really encouraged that policymakers of such stature and previously high-level service would be interested in coming to do an academic conference focused on religion as it was. So we were encouraged at that and found it a fascinating discussion.
Did you find that it was difficult to bring them in because they said, religion, nobody pays attention to that stuff?
Not in this case. I think you'll find with both Ross, Hadley, and Abrams are all very perceptive, even though they're not known as religion experts per se. Their experiences as policymakers had really seared in them an impression that religion needs to be taken seriously. It needs to be understood as a factor in international politics, especially given the Arab Spring. And so the only challenge in putting together the panel was just the scheduling, finding a time that would work for all three of them, given their very intensive travel schedules. But the topic itself really grabbed them. And I think was a reminder to us that policymakers are more and more having to pay attention to religion as an important issue, and when given an opportunity, we'll look for ways to speak on it.
Well, that's good to know, and I think you're leading the charge on this. You're one of the scholars at the Berkeley Center, along with Thomas Farr and Timothy Shaw, who are really trying to capture the attention of policymakers, because you're saying, hey, the world is changing. We need to change with it. We need to think about these new topics or new issues that are arising. And that gets us to this issue of the Arab Spring. I want to talk later about how religious liberty should be affecting our foreign policy for a bit. But so let's talk a little bit about this Arab Spring thing. I think it'd be helpful to first discuss the tumultuous events in the Middle East over the past 2 years that have been given that moniker, the Arab Spring. By understanding what is going on there, then we're going to be better able to explain how religion and or religious liberty should be playing a role in U.S. foreign policy. So what is this thing? What is the Arab Spring? How did it all start?
Well, as complicated as the Arab Spring is, I think we can, for our listeners, really boil it down to a sentence or two, which is it's a movement across the Middle East Middle Eastern citizens demanding more say in their future, demanding more voice in their government and how their countries are run. Now, that may be our quick summary of it, but it's in fact an incredibly complicated, multifaceted, not just movement, but series of movements. And even the question of when and how it started, people are going to come to different assessments on that. The common consensus, or I should say consensus, but the most common interpretation is that it started on December 17th, 2010, so just about 2 years ago, in Tunisia, which is a fairly small, less-known country in the Arab world, in North Africa there, when a Tunisian fruit vendor, a young Tunisian fruit vendor in his mid-20s named Mohamed Bouazizi, was frustrated with what he saw was some unjust treatment by the police. I guess they'd confiscated his fruit cart for selling without a license or something like that. And he took the extraordinary step of self-immolation. He set himself on fire, committed suicide to protest against this injustice. But here, what 10, 20, 30 years ago might have been just one sad and isolated incident that the rest of the world didn't know about, because of social media, because his self-immolation was videotaped, and because of Twitter and Facebook and all the other social media phenomena across the internet, awareness of Mohamed Bouazizi's protest and self-immolation spread quickly across the region. And so you soon saw a massive protest in Tunisia against the then government of President Ben Ali. This also spread to Egypt, to Yemen, to Libya, across the broader region, and led to several overthrows or changes of government in several countries, and instability in a number of other countries. I might add, though, that while that's probably the most common understanding of when the Arab Spring started, was 2 years ago in Tunisia, others who have now been looking at the movement think that it may actually be traced to the spring and summer of 2009 in Iran. Now, Iran is not an Arab country. It's a Persian country, and that's why I've been trying to say movements across the Middle Eastern region rather than just the Arab world. But as your listeners will probably remember, 2009 was when the Green Revolution took place in Iran, the massive protest against what was widely seen as the stolen election by the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And even though Iranians are Persian and predominantly Shia, whereas most of the rest of the Middle East is Arab and predominantly Sunni, there's a lot of awareness by people across the region of what goes on in each country. And our best understanding now is that the Green Movement, Green Revolution protest in Iran in 2009 may have really catalyzed the subsequent protest across the Arab world in 2010 and 2011. And so in that sense, the Mohamed Bouazizi protest in Tunisia, the self-immolation in December of 2010, while it really catalyzed the most recent set of events, it was taking place in a context when, over the last year and a half, people had already been frustrated, wanting more voice and accountability from their governments and more of a say in their own future.
It is really interesting to think about that. If you dig deeper, go back to, as you say, the Green Revolution in Iran in 2009 and changes that are taking place. Yeah, word is getting around the area saying, some people are speaking up. They don't like these kind of governments. They want greater say in their public affairs. And then it takes a small incident like that self-immolation that sets everything off, which, you know, and again, one of the things that I noticed that, you know, historically you see this quite frequently is that there was a funeral for Brazzi, and it was attended by tens of thousands of people. That's really where the protest started. And it was one of these safe spots where you could go, well, I'm very concerned about this fruit vendor who, you know, lit himself on fire and eventually died. And so it's safe to do that. But nonetheless, it's a political statement that people start looking at. And then all of a sudden, everybody else starts saying, oh, yeah, I'm not very happy with this either. And it basically starts a cascading effect.
Yeah, absolutely. And given how tightly controlled the sort of political and religious and social spaces were in most of the Middle Eastern countries, people had to find outlets for venting their frustrations, venting, you know, for freedom of expression wherever they could. In this case, it happened to be a funeral, which then fueled by social media, sent profound reverberations across the region. And it's also interesting, usually, you know, most scholars would say that, well, massive movements for social change are going to take place in big, pivotal, important countries. And of course, Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Iran are seen as the most, you know, pivotal and important countries across the Middle East. Those are the ones always jockeying for to be first, you know, first among equals there. But no one paid much attention to Tunisia. And yet here in this case, it was really Tunisia and a fairly obscure, like I said, unemployed fruit vendor who was the most immediate catalyst. And so it's also a good reminder of how just unexpected history can be and how profound change can come from areas that we don't anticipate.
Yeah. Now, you talked about Twitter and YouTube and all these things are, you know, being posted all around the internet and instantaneously being transmitted across the world to other countries. Has this largely been a popular uprising, or have there been certain segments, organized segments of society that have taken a greater role in prompting this transformation?
Well, I hate to resort to the typical professorial academic response on this, but I'm going to have to, so indulge me. It's complicated. I would say yes to all the factors you mentioned there. On the one hand, this has been a spontaneous popular uprising. I think there just was widespread frustration across by average citizens across the region at feeling like their economies are stagnant, their political systems are repressive, and they just have no say in determining their own future. But at the same time, you did have also across the region different, you know, organized factions and groups and movements, particularly some of the Islamist movements, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood in several of these countries, the Salafis in Egypt, who already had some pre-existing organizations and networks and leaders. And so when protests start happening, when upheaval starts happening, when the old order is really destabilized, some of these other groups and movements can then step in and take advantage of it. And because they have more organization, because they have more of their own solidified leadership networks, they were able to direct it in certain directions that they wanted it to go. And that's why the future still is uncertain and really at multiple crossroads here. And that's also why I know the title of our program here is Arab Spring, and that was a moniker given to it, to these movements back in the spring of 2011 when there was a lot more hope that these would lead to, you know, peaceful and pluralistic democratic transformations. But a lot of folks are now calling it just the Arab Awakening, meaning, yes, incredible ferment and tumult is happening, but we're not sure that it will result in peaceful, democratic, pluralistic new political orders, but the final outcome is still very, very uncertain. We know it's going to be different. We know it already is profoundly different. Whether it will be overall a very, very good thing still remains to be seen.
Well, we're definitely going to plunge into that topic, but I just want to focus on a few things. You mentioned that Yemen, Libya, a few other countries were involved in this. What are some of the other countries that were involved? Is Syria included in this, underneath this umbrella known as the Arab Spring or Arab Awakening?
Yeah, Syria absolutely would be included. It's gone in a maybe a series of waves, if you will, that are still cascading. So the initial wave was Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, and then Yemen, actually. And those are now the four countries who have seen regime changes, who have seen leadership changes, whether it's Gaddafi being ousted by the rebellion and then the NATO operation in Libya, or President Saleh in Yemen being ousted by a combination of indigenous protests and then some Western pressure. Mubarak, of course, being ousted in Egypt by the popular uprising, and then, as we mentioned, President Ben Ali in Tunisia. So those were the four countries at the first wave of this. You also had Bahrain, interestingly, especially during 2011, seeing widespread protests by the mostly Shia population against the Sunni monarchy there. But those protests were not successful. The government successfully quelled those with actually a military intervention from Saudi Arabia and from some of the other Gulf states there. Then in the second wave of the Arab Spring, maybe starting around a sort of summer and fall of 2011, that's when Syria really enters the picture, where a growing rebellion against the Assad regime by a lot of Syrian citizens began. And that is now, as our listeners know, turned into pretty much a full-on civil war, where our best estimates are over 40,000 Syrian civilians have been killed by the Assad regime, by far the highest death toll, the highest levels of bloodshed of any of the Arab Awakening, let's call it now, movements.
Are there any potential changes on the horizon? Are people looking out in the policy community and saying, whoa, you know, we've had this first wave, we had Syria now, but now we're maybe looking at Saudi Arabia, or something might be happening in the United Arab Emirates, or, you know, who else? I mean, is there any talk about how this might be spreading, or any hotspots?
Yeah, there is, and again, I'm not an active policymaker myself anymore, but I certainly keep in touch with those who are, and I'll mention a few countries, some of which you already alluded to, that people are keeping a close eye on. One is certainly Saudi Arabia. We've not seen the widespread protests there yet, but Saudi is such a closed society anyway that it's hard to know what exactly is going on there. But you have a very old monarch, King Abdullah, in failing health, and a fairly uncertain succession model. I mean, they every time they've picked a crown prince to succeed him, that crown prince has died. They've now had the last two heir apparents die.
Wow, I would not want to be picked as the next heir apparent.
That's right. Yeah, that's
you
right.
Can keep that title. I'm fine. Yeah.
That's right. So again, we don't. I'm not by any means predicting the imminent regime change in Saudi Arabia, but there's a lot of uncertain factors there, and that's one to keep an eye on. Another one is Jordan. Again, King Abdullah there has tried to get out front of the protests and reform movements by some modest measures of political liberalization, but there's still widespread discontent in Jordan, especially with the large Palestinian refugee population there. So that's another one to keep an eye on. Let's not forget Iran. I think a lot of the Iranians who were frustrated that their reform movement did not succeed in 2009 have watched the unfolding of these reform movements and protests across the rest of the region, and maybe thinking, well, there's going to be, our time may come again. And again, especially as the confrontation over Iran's nuclear program heats up, the domestic political ferment could be another factor to keep an eye on. And then we go back to Bahrain. The fact that the protests were put down there before does not mean that we won't be seen more again. So Saudi, Jordan, Bahrain, and Iran would be at least four countries I would highlight. But then I should also mention, anytime anyone makes any predictions on these things, we get these things wrong.
Yeah.
This is one of the fascinations of international politics and the unfolding of history, is no one can really predict where it's going to go. And sometimes when people do make bold assertions, they can be wildly wrong, or wildly dismissed. I've found it interesting to look back on the early part of this century. As listeners may recall, in 2003, former President George W. Bush, at the end of 2003, gave a speech at the National Endowment for Democracy, saying, "The old order in the Middle East cannot stand anymore. This support for autocratic regimes is just really unstable, and the people of the region want more of a voice in their future. They want more accountability from their government, and it's time for the United States policy to catch up with that." And Bush was, you know, widely lambasted at the time for being unrealistic, for being too much of a visionary, and not really understanding the realities of the region. But looking back, your listeners might want to take a look at that speech. It's his National Endowment for Democracy speech from November 2003, and I think he was rather prophetic there, at least in saying the old order just cannot stand. And looking back, I wish we as the United States government would have been a little more bold in trying to get out front of these things and push for reform a little more ambitiously when we had more leverage, because now events are currently largely out of our control.
Yeah, well, we'll go ahead and link to that November 2003 Bush National Endowment speech on our website, so folks should get back there and check that out, as well as the number of writings that you have done. We'll also put those on our website. In talking about trying to promote democracy in the region, and a few minutes ago we were talking about the Arab Spring, and you said, yeah, we're using this term several months ago, but now people are starting to say, well, let's call it the Arab Awakening. Usually when we talk about spring, we're signaling new beginnings, and these old autocratic regimes were being ousted, and scholars and pundits were thinking, democracy is on the way in. We've seen this before in Eastern Europe and many in Latin America and a few other places like that. But the fact that you said, well, we're changing our lingo a little bit, we're moving away from spring, new beginning, to awakening, which is a little bit more ambiguous in terms of what is going to come out from this. What is the general assessment right now, or what are scholars thinking about in terms of, is this going in a liberal democratic direction or not?
Yeah, folks I talk to, whether in the policy community or the scholarly community, are, again, opinions run across the gamut, but unfortunately, I would say it's a gamut that goes from deep pessimism to mild skepticism. I don't see a lot of optimism, I guess, in other words. To use the political theorist Francis Fukuyama's definitions, what we need here is liberal democracy. So democracy refers to the procedural aspects, you know, open, free, and fair elections that recur, not just one man, one vote, one time. But then the liberal part refers to the protections of the rule of law, the constitutional protections for minority rights, for an appropriate separation of powers. These are the sort of things that prevent the liberal institutions are what prevent just democracy from turning into majoritarianism, which is, you know, a fancy political science term for mob rule, essentially.
Right, right.
And so I think the worry is that while we're seeing different semblances of elections in some of these places, that if they're not accompanied by those liberal institutional protections, again, of rights for minorities, of rights for those who are on the losing end of the ballot, that we're not going to be seeing true democracy at all, but rather some of these majoritarian governments that may then just turn purely autocratic and may have at least some elements of religious extremism as well. So there's some worrisome trends there. Now, I'm not ready to give up entirely, and I continue to advocate for active, you know, American engagement in the region to essentially be supporting the moderate pluralistic voices and to be making clear that we oppose the extremist voices who seem to be ascendant, at least in some of these countries.
Yeah, there always is that effect during big revolutionary times that things are going to dramatically change, but then there's always that old saying, meet the old boss, same as the new boss. And
yeah,
it might be the case where, you know, replacing more secular type of authoritarian leaders, you know, from the Ba'athist regime in Syria to, you know, Mubarak's regime, which, you know, has its roots more in a much more secular authoritarian trend in Egypt over the past half century, and just replacing them with an authoritarian regime with a different religious flavor. And I think there's some concern about this, because if you think about the current popular uprising here, it's occurring in an environment where groups like Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Taliban, and a number of other jihadist groups have been ascendant, or at least been holding ground. And this must be affecting things. You know, the recent attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, certainly shows that these groups are present, and they're very active in trying to change the political landscape or shape the political landscape. Is there any concern that this popular uprising is has some kind of democratic flavor to it, but again, you have these fairly well-organized militant groups that might be able to take it in different directions?
Yeah, I mean, I think you really put your finger on the nub of the concerns there. I mean, I'll highlight a couple ways. One, backing up a little bit, in the first few months of the Arab Awakening, one thing that a lot of us found encouraging was that Al-Qaeda and the jihadist groups seemed to have nothing to do with this, that they were caught. If anyone who was caught by more surprise than the U.S. government was on this, it was Al-Qaeda and the extremist groups. They were really caught with their pants down on this thing, too. And it also put the lie to a lot of Al-Qaeda's grievance narrative that all the problems in the Middle East are caused by Western oppression and by Israel and that kind of stuff. And rather, this seemed to be a lot of people in the region saying, no, our problems are caused by our autocratic, unresponsive governments who are not creating conditions for economic growth and political expression, and we're going to take our future into our own hands. But now, a couple years in, it seems that some of the extremist groups, some of the jihadist groups, Al-Qaeda and its different affiliates have recovered and have now tried to get out front of these movements and have more of a voice in it, and often a very, very unhelpful voice. Again, we're seeing a proliferation of different Al-Qaeda-related groups in places like Libya, again in Yemen. There's some worrisome signs that they're taking advantage of the tumult and the ferment in Syria as well. So that would be one set of concerns there that could really hijack these movements and take it in some very bad ways. And again, this is a real missed opportunity, I think, for the United States, because I think a more aggressive and creative public diplomacy effort on the part of the Obama administration 2 years ago to delegitimize the jihadist narrative, to point out that these Arab Awakening movements show that Al-Qaeda has been flat wrong and should have no appeal for Muslims across the region. I think that was a missed opportunity, and Al-Qaeda has recovered more quickly than we have. But then there's also just the basic question of governance. And now that some new governments are in place in Tunisia, in Yemen, in Egypt especially, which is really going to be pivotal, we're not sure if these governments will respect minority and human rights. The signs are worrisome, frankly, especially in Egypt. But there's also the basic question: will these governments deliver on day-to-day services for their people? Will the trains and buses run on time? Will the trash be picked up? Will the economy start to grow again? We've certainly seen that Hamas's governance in the Gaza Strip has completely failed on this count. And I don't know if Hamas could win an open, free, and fair election there again, as they did that the one time in 2006. Likewise, will the Morsi government, the Muslim Brotherhood-dominated government in Egypt, will it be able to deliver sort of the basic order and basic services that people in Egypt are going to be expecting from their government? And if they can't do that, then I think a lot of the citizens of Egypt of various religious and ideological persuasions, whether more liberal or more conservative or more Islamist or not Islamist at all, might grow impatient, put more pressure on their government to actually get back to the bread and butter of what good governance is, rather than pursuing any sort of religious or ideological agenda. And so that's a countervailing dynamic that could also bring a new chapter into the game, and could certainly undermine some of the Islamist groups who are trying to use this as an opportunity to advance themselves.
Well, I definitely am interested in the issue of good governance, getting buses to run on time and trash being picked up, because actually today at our house the trash is being picked up, and I do appreciate that, as citizens do all around the world. But I want to focus this more on human rights, given that we're a podcast on religion. Specifically, I want to focus it on the issue of religious freedom. What is happening in terms of religious freedom in these Arab awakening countries? I mean, we hear anecdotal stories about Coptic churches being attacked in Egypt, but, you know, for us lay folks who are, you know, are not paying too much attention to that situation, this could just be one or two incidents that make a splash in the news or our friends tell us about it, but it doesn't really represent the broader situation. Is there concern about what is happening to religious minorities? Is there a broader concern here? And how does this connect with religious freedom?
I do think that absolutely there's a big concern about religious freedom across the region, especially religious minorities. But here I'd put the concerns in two categories, really. One is the question of religious minorities in the region. So this would especially be Coptic Christians in Egypt, who are, it's hard to get the exact figures, but probably about 10% of the population there, who were discriminated against and repressed under the Mubarak government, and who initially had some hopes for more freedom, for more tolerance, for more of their human rights to be respected under after Mubarak is gone. But if anything, the Copts have seen, I think, a widespread regression in their treatment. And we'll come back to them in a little bit. But the other category of religious freedom concern is religious freedom for Muslims. And that may sound discordant to some of your listeners who see these Islamist governments coming into power, especially in a place like Egypt. But not all Muslims are Islamists. Islamism, a clumsy term as it is, you know, refers to political Islam, to efforts to impose Islamic law, Sharia, on the rest of the country. And a lot of more moderate, pluralistic Muslims across the region, especially in Egypt, don't want that, don't support that. That's not their interpretation of Islam. And if these Islamist governments dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood are going to be taking power and institutionalizing their power, they're going to be violating the religious freedom of other Muslims who don't share that radical Islamist agenda. And I think we really need to expand our discussion of and our understanding of what religious freedom means to say we want religious freedom for all people, including the Muslims who are having their rights trampled on by other Muslims. We saw this in Iraq. This was one of the sources of the awakening in Iraq and the eventual turnaround there, when Al-Qaeda and some of these extremist groups were taking over certain regions of Iraq in 2006 especially, and trying to impose very draconian medieval forms of Sharia law on other Iraqi Muslims. And eventually a lot of the Iraqi Muslims, Sunni and Shia, said, enough, we don't want this. This is not our understanding of Islam, our religious freedom. They wouldn't necessarily use that term, but that concept is being violated here. And so the particularly Western actors like the United States, I think we need to be a lot more assertive in trying to promote religious freedom across the region. And absolutely that means paying attention to the plight of religious minorities such as Christians. But it also means paying attention to the religious freedom of, you know, the silent majority, if you will, or Muslims in these countries who don't want to be under an Islamist government that violates their rights.
That is such a great point, and it's one that really escaped my mind as I was preparing for this interview, and you do an excellent job to remind me of this, is that we often tend to think of Islam as being just this one monolithic block religion, but it's actually an incredibly pluralistic religion. And us folks here in the West, well, we think of Islam and then Christianity, or Islam and religious minorities, but there's a great deal, as I mentioned, a great deal of pluralism within Islam. And it, you know, you're very correct to point out that favoring one flavor or one specific denominational aspect of Islam does not do justice to a lot of the other people who do not share that flavor of Islam.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll go one step further and say, really, I think the single most important determining factor in the future of the Arab Awakening, the most dispositive thing on how it's going to play out, is going to be this question of religious freedom. And again, as long as we consider religious freedom in a broad context of religious freedom for all people, especially those Muslims in these countries who are the majority of the citizens, but who don't support an Islamist agenda. But as we saw in the case of the Egyptian elections, the more liberal and moderate-minded Muslims got completely outmaneuvered and outorganized and outcampaigned by the Islamists in the Muslim Brotherhood. And so they're really the ones that we in the West, I think, would prefer to see win, and who would have a more democratic future for Egypt, have been the ones who got their clocks cleaned.
Yeah, You know, so that's a concern for everybody. Yeah. So that's religious freedom in general. And I want to come back to that in terms of U.S. policy and how we end up promoting that, or if we should at all. But what about religious minorities? You mentioned we were going to come back to the Coptic Christians, and I'm sure there's a few other Christian groups that are scattered throughout the Middle East and some of these countries experiencing the Arab awakening. How have they been faring?
Yeah, my first comment on that will be I've been grieved to see that there so little attention has been paid to their plight in the West. I mean, a lot of our headlines have been about the Muslim Brotherhood and the latest protest or this or that, but much less attention has been paid to the plight of religious minorities, especially the Christians of the region. And this would be Copts in Egypt, but also evangelicals. There's a smaller but still important population of evangelical Christians in Egypt. And then Christians in Syria of both Orthodox and Catholic backgrounds. Very small Christian population in Yemen. A small Christian population in Jordan as well. And this is where I think we can say that as a diagnostic, as an indicator of the future of the region, look at how the Christians are going to be treated, because often how a country, a society, a government treats its religious minorities is a real bellwether for the overall health and vibrancy or lack thereof of democracy in the region, in the country in question. So with the Copts in Egypt, as I mentioned earlier, they were essentially second-class citizens under Mubarak. They had restrictive laws against being able to repair or build new churches. They were severely discriminated against in government hiring and the economic order of the country more broadly. And occasionally they were subject to horribly one-sided conversion laws, where in Egypt it was legal and even encouraged to convert from Christianity to Islam, but it was illegal to convert from Islam to Christianity. And we would regularly see cases of imprisonment and torture even of Muslims in Egypt who had tried to convert to Christianity, whereas you'd see a lot of inducements and government support for conversions from Christianity to Islam. So it was not a good, I guess bottom line is it was not a good situation for Christians in Egypt under Mubarak. This is why a lot of Egyptian Christians were very supportive of the original protest movement, in Tahrir Square that eventually brought down Mubarak. It's kind of this few weeks, a wonderful window of interreligious cooperation of democratic-minded Christians and democratic-minded Muslims cooperating and working together and saying, we are all Egyptians and really wanting a better future for themselves. Things have turned much worse. It's a bad situation now. With the Islamist movements, especially the Muslim Brotherhood, kind of hijacking the Egyptian revolution and now dominating the government, you're seeing two trends. One is just with a lack of effective governance and preservation of order, there have been a lot of mob attacks on Christian churches, on properties, on individual Christians in Egypt that have gone unpunished. And so that's where it's been almost this quasi-state of anarchy there that has really left a lot of the Christians victimized. And as bad as things were under the Mubarak regime, for the most part, the Mubarak government would not tolerate things getting so out of order like that. It would give at least some minimal police protection to the Christian communities. There are exceptions to that, but again, that was the general state of affairs. But then also you're starting to see more and more government-sanctioned discrimination and marginalization of the Copts, the Christians in Egypt as well. If anything, things may be taking more of a step back. I mean, they have very little, if any, representation. I don't know the exact numbers in the new parliament. We'll need to check on that, but I know it's not good. And now, after the passing of the late Pope Shenouda, who had been the head of the Coptic Church in Egypt, the new pope is really trying to figure out his new place in the order and how he can stand up and advocate for his community while the situation is shifting dramatically around him. There's a question of how much political players should the Coptic Church be in the new Egyptian order or not. That remains to be seen. But again, overall, the signs are not encouraging. Let me say a quick, that was a longer answer, but let me say a quick word as well about Christians in Syria. This is where, because the Assad regime in Syria is itself a minority faith, they're Alawites, it's a minority subset derivation of Shiism, and the majority of Syrian citizens are Sunni Muslim. Already you had the Assad regime was sort of equal opportunity repressors, if you will, and they actually had carved out a little bit of space for Christians in the country, the minority Christians in Syria, just because the Assad regime did not see the Christians as a threat to its legitimacy. But again, now that Syria has descended into a state of civil war, and the Christians have been essentially been on the sidelines and trying to figure out who are what side are they going to support, they're very worried, understandably, that if the jihadist groups, the Islamist groups, succeed in controlling the Syrian uprising and Syrian revolution, that would not be good for the Christians. But I think the Christians have started to realize that their future is certainly not with the Assad regime either, and so they. As a small minority community, I think the fate of Syrian Christians in whatever new order emerges in Syria will also be a strong indicator of the overall health of that order.
Yeah, they're somewhat in a situation of limbo.
And I personally wish they would have been more outspoken in their criticism of the Assad regime and more supportive of the initial protests against him. Yeah. But that's easy for me to say from the comfort of my office here in Austin, Texas.
So. Yeah. I like what you're saying here, that first of all, how a government treats its minorities, be it religious minorities, ethnic minorities, or whatever other classification we want to bring up, is really a bellwether for the democratic health of a regime, specifically in terms of civil liberties. But you also mentioned that it's not just religious minorities, it's Muslims in general, that religious liberty is not just important for minorities, but it's important for everybody within the country. And this is a theme that you talked about at the Berkeley Center's symposium on religious liberty and foreign policy back in March of 2002. And as I mentioned, you had a number of different policymakers there. And we should note that this was before the Benghazi incident in Libya. And this was obviously before President Morsi's consolidation of power or attempt to consolidate power.
A quick clarification on the date, it was March 2012. I think you said March 2002. So,
oh, okay.
I would have loved to have done this conference 10 years ago. We would have been really prophetic on the Arab Spring. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah, it would have been. I know. So 2012. So roughly about, you know, 9 months ago or so.
Yeah.
And so you had folks there like Elliot Abrams, Stephen Hadley, who were both appointees in the Bush administration. And then you also had another guy there, Dennis Ross. He was in the Clinton administration, Obama appointee as well currently. I think he might have also served with George H.W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
What came out of this conference? What were some of the concerns raised about the, I guess, Arab Spring, as you were calling it then, maybe we could call it Arab Awakening now, and the issue of religious liberty and democracy more generally? Was there a sense of optimism at the time saying, yeah, things are going in the right direction? Or did some of these policymakers say, whoa, there is a problem. We better think about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a few things that I remember fairly vividly from that conference. First, more generally, just the real sense, even though you had former senior policymakers from both parties, from multiple administrations, the shared sense that they all had that, wow, this stuff really caught us by surprise. Not to say that it had been completely inconceivable that there'd be these reform movements. Again, Hadley and Abrams had both had an active hand in some of the early Bush administration reform efforts in the Middle East, and even the writing of that the November 2003 speech I mentioned. But still, it's one thing to say that at some point that the current order can't continue, and at some point in the future there will be these big, there will be a need for reform. It's an entirely other thing to say when and where and how it will happen. And that's the real nub. And we saw that at the conference, some of the differences between some of the scholars who are there saying, oh, you policymakers, you should know that these reform movements are eventually going to happen, and policymakers saying, well, sure, anyone can say that a government will not last forever, but for policymakers, we need to know much more specifics, when and where and how will it change. And so a strong collective sense among Hadley, Abrams, and Ross that this thing was, no one could have predicted the specifics of how this played out, and that makes policymaking very, very difficult. A second strong sense that came out was for the fact the United States is still the most powerful country in the world and still probably the most influential non-Middle Eastern country in the Middle East, in terms of if any outside country that's not based in the Middle East, the United States would be of that category that would be the most influential. Still, how limited American leverage is on these things. Yeah, we have aid packages to Egypt that we can maybe tweak or increase or reduce or condition. We have military forces we can move around. We have ambassadors who can issue sternly worded day marches, to use one of the State Department's favorite expressions. But this thing is just not in America's control, and that could be very challenging for a policymaker, because you go into policy, you're interested in doing what are things that I can do to change things, to make a difference, to exercise American influence, and the levers there were very limited. And then the third thing specifically that came out from the discussion, specifically on the religion and religious freedom angle, was I think a sense of puzzlement that on the one hand, all three policymakers were very savvy, very experienced, and very, I think, acutely sensitive to religion in their own different ways. But on the other hand, some puzzlement, what is the role of religion and religious freedom in these new movements? How can we pay attention to it? Who are the religious voices we need to listen to? Who are the religious voices that, frankly, are dangerous and need to be marginalized? And how can the United States, as a certainly a predominantly non-Muslim, secular pluralistic country, how can we exercise influence for religious freedom in this region? And that's where I think they also realized that their policy tools were limited. And that was maybe seen as more of a ambitious longer-term question when they're also just trying to deal with some of the day-to-day crises of, in Dennis Ross's case, when and how do we tell Mubarak to step down and things like that. So I personally would have liked to have heard a little bit more from the policymakers on their future ideas for how the United States could have a more effective religious freedom policy in the region, because as I said earlier on the podcast, I think the disposition of religious freedom will be absolutely central to the future of the Arab Awakening, positive or negative, but that's where our government still has a ways to go, and that's why I'm glad you gave the nice plug earlier to the Religious Freedom Project at Georgetown's Berkeley Center, which Tom Farr and Tim Shaw direct, and I'm honored to be a part of, because I think that team there is really trying to do some creative, strategic, forward-thinking work on both the theory and the practice of religious freedom and what it means for American foreign policy.
Yeah, no, and they're kind of drawing me into that circle as well. I'll be coming out to Washington, D.C. in a few weeks to meet with the Berkeley Center on another project as well. And
I think I will see you there. So, hey, all your listeners, this is the beginning of a beautiful collaboration between Gill and Inboden. So,
I think that's true. And I think you owe me a couple beers or whiskeys there, too. So,
that's right. Or glasses of cold milk for our teetotaling listeners.
Huh? There you go. That sounds good. I like the point that you make, and I've had discussions with other people before that, policymakers want to come in and make a lot of changes. They don't feel like they have a great deal of leverage in some cases. The things move too fast. They get focused on the day-to-day things rather than the big issues. But the symposium did do a very good job of pointing out why some of the bigger issues are important and have to be worked into some of our day-to-day policy decisions. One of the arguments that came out of the symposium, and again, I'm going to link to the paper that came out of this for our listeners so that they can get a good read on this. The idea was that religious freedom will help promote religious moderation or at least diminish extremism. What is the logic behind that?
Yeah, this is an important theoretical insight or theory that we would love to see more in practice, which is the only groups who really don't want religious freedom are the extremist groups who want to impose their more radical, autocratic, intolerant agenda of religion on everyone else. And so the way to counter that, the way to promote more religious pluralism and religious moderation, is to have religious freedom, which means protection for all the different religious communities to advance their religious beliefs in the public square, to practice their faith, to implement it in their own faith communities, to participate in the political order based on religious convictions. That sort of pluralism will, by its very nature, prevent any one vision from dominating and from squelching everyone else, and will therefore promote more moderation. The other part of that is One thing that we've seen with religious extremist groups is they really don't like to be criticized. They want to say that ours is the only interpretation of Islam. And if that's all anyone ever hears, and if you're not hearing alternative viewpoints, then, well, for understandable reasons, you might think, well, I guess that's what Islam is whatever Zawahiri or the Muslim Brotherhood or some of the more extremist voices are saying. But if you have protections for religious freedom, which would mean in that case that, say, liberal and moderate Muslims can speak up and say, no, this is our understanding of Islam, and it does allow freedoms for Christians and Jews and other minorities. It doesn't impose its version of Sharia law on the rest of the country. It doesn't require women to wear headscarves. It doesn't ban non-Muslim dietary elements like alcohol and pork and things like that. If you have those alternative voices speaking up and saying, here's our understanding of Islam, then that will provide a critique of the extremists. That will provide alternatives to the extremism. And it will create a contest of ideas where other people can say, okay, well, maybe this is the version of Islam we want to follow and not that one. So it doesn't necessarily mean that everyone will be persuaded, but it will prevent the extremist version itself from actually dominating and squelching out all the voices. That at least is the hope or the theory. Unfortunately, it hasn't really been given much of a chance to be tried in practice because most of the countries of the region have gone from autocratic to now at least trending in some theocratic directions. Although I would say that return to Tunisia, where a lot of this started, we are seeing some more promising signs for. So even though Tunisia is a strongly Muslim-majority country, the early signs are that the new Tunisian constitution and political order will be more conducive to religious freedom.
Has there been any dissenting voices on this? Are there people that are out there saying, nah, maybe religious freedom doesn't necessarily lead to this religious moderation that you speak of?
There certainly are dissenting voices. I mean, the theory I just laid out, not everyone would agree with. I'd say those dissenting voices fall into two camps, ironically. These two camps would normally not have much to do with each other. One camp would be some thinkers in the West, some thinkers in the United States who essentially say, look, religion is just a problem. Religion is bad. Religion causes people to be superstitious. It causes them to be authoritarian, blah, blah, blah. And they're lumping essentially all religion, or at least all Islam, into this. And so those voices say, we want the old days back. We want a fairly secular ruler like Mubarak in Egypt who will just keep religion controlled, who will keep all the mosque sermons controlled, who just won't allow religion out there at all. Because if you allow religious expression, everyone's inevitably going to become an extremist, an Islamist, that kind of thing. So that would be one camp. The other camp, who doesn't like this vision of religious freedom and religious pluralism, would be the guys on the other side. It would be the Islamists themselves who say, that's right, we are the only ones who have the correct interpretation of Islam, and it does include draconian implementation of Sharia law. It does include no rights whatsoever for religious minorities such as Jews or Christians or other Muslims who disagree with this. And so they don't like that vision either. So it's one of those cases of politics making rather strange bedfellows.
Yeah. One of the concerns that I raised at a previous conference on this back in Princeton a year or two ago was, I should mention that I share the idea that religious liberty is going to eventually lead to religious moderation, in that there's a kind of a balance of power effect, right? Is that once the number of religious denominations and faith traditions multiplies, everybody kind of realizes, well, we all have to get along together so that we can get along. Mm-hmm. But there's that period of transition that can be very difficult, because if you all of a sudden open up the floodgates and say, okay, religious liberty is fine, do whatever you want, there are being some groups that have been privileged or advantaged in the previous environment that are going to find themselves in some ways losing out. And my concern in many ways, and I'd like to know if you share this, is that when you do open up for greater religious freedom in the country, there's going to be some shifting of the religious landscape, and that's going to lead to a lot of possible persecution, a lot of conflict. And it's one of these things that, in the long run, this is all going to pay off, but right now, buckle your seatbelts, it's going to be a bumpy ride.
Mm-hmm. The devil really is in the details. You're absolutely right. The devil with a capital D, even, potentially. But the concern you raise there is about the instability of political transitions, the instability of democratic transitions more broadly. And this applies in the security context. You know, as you know, some good political science literature has shown that when states are going through a democratic transition and they're weak or fragile democracies, that may be when they're most prone to conflict, even though strong, stable democracies are least prone to conflict. Same with religious freedom and religious pluralism. Is during these times of political change, of political ferment, when the old order is slipping away and there's questions about what the new one will look like, well, different groups are going to be jockeying for advantage. There's potentially going to be mistrust of others, and there can be a real zero-sum mentality of how do we consolidate our gains, especially if you're the Muslim Brotherhood, how do we seize as much power as we can, and how do we really put the hurt on the other guy? And this is where some of the Arab awakening countries have been encountering some real turbulence and some really, really worrisome trends. And if they don't make it through this delicate transition period when some of the religious minority groups may be especially vulnerable, and Egypt is exhibit A here, then the longer-term trends are very worrisome. So we can all sit back and think in theory how we would like the future to turn out, and I certainly have, you know, my hopes for a promising future, but if we don't make it through these precarious transition times, the future could actually look really bleak.
And this is the opening of foreign policy here in the United States, right? This is where we possibly could make an important difference to help ease that transition period out. And you recently wrote an article in the journal Policy Review entitled Religious Freedom and National Security, Why the U.S. Should Make a Connection. In our closing minutes here, I do want to give you a chance to talk about that article a little bit. It might be somewhat surprising for a number of our listeners or people who pick up Policy Review and see that. They say, religious freedom and national security. Usually when I think of national security, I'm thinking, you know, let's stop nuclear proliferation. Let's, you know, talk about disarmament, securing borders, all those kind of things. But religious freedom, why would religious freedom matter to national security?
Well, no, great question. I appreciate you mentioning the Policy Review article, and I would, you know, love to hear any feedback from your listeners who have a chance to read that article. I'll start with saying first the theoretical argument I lay out in the article, and then I'll share a couple anecdotes that were behind it, is that I'm not aware of any country out there, to put it positively, that respects religious freedom and poses a security threat to the United States. And on the negative side, when I was looking at most of the countries that do seem to pose security threats to the United States, those are also countries that are severe violators of religious freedom. You know, North Korea, Iran, potentially China. Is that just merely a coincidence on the positive side and on the negative side, or is there perhaps some sort of correlation there? And I'd first started to think about this question, actually, in the late 1990s when I was working as a staff member on Capitol Hill on religious freedom issues. And we started getting some really worrisome reports coming out of Afghanistan, of all places. Keep in mind, this is the late 1990s. This awful regime that called the Taliban had taken over in Afghanistan, and no one had heard of these guys before, and they seemed really bad. And why do we know they were bad? Well, a number of reasons. First, they were imposing their extreme version of Islam on the rest of the country. And so Afghan Muslims who were not extremists were feeling like their religious freedom was being violated because they were being told by the Taliban, you know, you've got to follow our version of extreme Sharia law, which means no women's education and, you know, execution for adulterers and lopping off the hands of criminals and this kind of stuff. But then we also saw real concerns for some of the very few religious minorities, non-Muslims, in Afghanistan. Some Christian missionaries who were there were being arrested. A few Afghan citizens who had converted from Islam to Christianity were being arrested and executed. And then some of your listeners may remember those ancient Buddhist statues in Afghanistan that were, part of the, I think, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. The Taliban blew those up because they didn't want any non-Muslim religious artifacts or symbols anywhere in the country. Well, so this is the late 1990s, and, you know, I and some of my colleagues in Capitol Hill are working on religious freedom issues, and we realize, wow, this is really worrisome what's going on in Afghanistan from a religious freedom vantage point. But nobody else would pay attention to it. Why? Because Afghanistan was seen as not part of the American national interest. Didn't have any oil. It wasn't strategically located. It was impoverished. No economic relationships there. It was a completely powerless country that barely had any military whatsoever. Why should we care about all that?
Yeah, and that's, those are only Buddhist statues, too. It's not like
that's
a
right.
Deal. It's
Buddhist
not like
statues, nuclear right. So if they were Baptist statues, then we'd care. So yeah. If there's a statue of Billy Graham they blew up, then we'd care, right? So, well, anyway, I'm sure listeners know where I'm going with this, but remember, put yourselves back in the late 1990s. Why would we have cared about Afghanistan? Well, the same conditions that were so appalling for religious freedom advocates and for Christians in Afghanistan were appealing to Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. And they thought, boy, this is jihadist heaven for us. This is terrorist heaven. This is exactly the kind of place we would like to live and set up our terrorist training camps and support the Taliban government, et cetera, et cetera. And as we later know, all too tragically, September 11th, 2001, al-Qaeda launches its terrorist attacks on the United States from Afghanistan. Well, my argument in the article essentially expands on that connection there, that if we pay attention to severe violations of religious freedom, we may also see some early warning signs of security threats to the United States from jihadist terrorism or from other forms of nefarious actors who wish the United States ill, because people who want to hurt the United States and hurt free countries are also often the same kind of people who want to repress religious freedom.
Yeah, it's as you mentioned before, the religious freedom is a bellwether for a forthcoming democracy, but religious restrictions on religious liberty are a bellwether in the opposite direction, I guess.
Yeah.
Let me give you as the United States, we might want to promote this. Again, it's as you make a case that it's in our national interest. If you promote religious liberty, it's going to promote religious moderation over time, and everything's going to be hunky-dory. But what about the flip side of the coin? Let me give you some counter arguments here. If the United States starts to promote religious liberty in other countries, let's say Egypt or Libya or Syria, could that be seen by people in this country as the U.S. meddling in their affairs, and that just give rise to more extremism? In fact, some of the moderates are saying, hey, yeah, we want religious freedom, but, you know, U.S. coming in here and telling us to do that, no, we don't like that. We might actually listen to some of the arguments of the extremists now, because they were telling us, they were warning us of this great U.S. power trying to force us to live the way that they want us to live.
Well, no, you raise a good question, and this is one that religious freedom advocates, myself included, have heard a lot over the years, which is that American support for religious freedom is really just meddling in these other countries. To that I would say that the people we hear that from the most often are the leaders of these other countries who don't want religious freedom. And so, of course, they're going to say, well, that's just American meddling. But I've rarely, if ever, encountered a situation where religious citizens of other countries who want more religious freedom, they always are going to welcome outside support and encouragement. Now, that doesn't mean that they will endorse necessarily every tactic or policy that's used. That's where we need wise policymakers who can understand the local culture and circumstances and what's possible. And that's for save that for a whole nother podcast. But the principle of American support, of outside support for religious freedom, I'll just put it plainly, this is not America imposing its values on other countries. This is America supporting the desires that people already have in those countries. I don't know if you'll find hardly anyone in the world who would say, who would answer no to the question, do you want to be free to practice your religion as you understand it? Everyone wants to be able to do that. Even extremists want to be able to do that. The problem with the extremists is they then want to take away the rights of everyone else to be able to. But on that basic question, do you want to be free to practice your faith and worship your God as you understand it? Just about everyone in the world would answer yes to that. And it's that impulse that I think the American government and other freedom-minded governments need to support. So it's not America imposing itself. It's rather just us responding to the desires, the needs, the aspirations of human beings all over the world, especially in countries like those across the Middle East where they don't have that freedom, and especially in countries across the Middle East where if there were more of that religious freedom, it would actually make more healthy, free, prosperous societies that don't support terrorism and that are more conducive to American interests anyway.
You make a great point that it's the populations in general, people living their day-to-day lives and on the street in their homes and their synagogues and temples and mosques and churches, that this matters a great deal to. And yet it seems that our foreign policy issues, or excuse me, our foreign policy efforts and our diplomatic efforts are oftentimes aimed at the high-level officials in these countries. As you mentioned, some of these are the people who don't like to see that kind of meddling in there. Is there any thought being given to a foreign policy response to what is going on in the Middle East by reaching out to the general population rather than just negotiating diplomatic terms at the highest levels of office?
Again, another great question. I guess I have good news and bad news there. I mean, the good news is there is a much wider awareness now in the State Department, in the American embassies across the region, across the globe, that foreign policy is not just what one high-level government official says to another high-level government official, but rather foreign policy is all of the interactions that one country has with another, especially our diplomats having interactions with religious leaders, with average citizens, with non-diplomats in these other countries. So there's an awareness that really needs to take place. But the bad news is it's a lot harder to do it, and our government, our State Department, just has not been very well equipped to be able to do that. And so that's why, I feel like we're still playing catch up with a lot of what's happening across the Arab awakening, figuring out who do we talk to, how can we get them to listen to us, how can we learn more from them. I'll just share a couple of anecdotes there from friends who've worked in the region, and again, this is where another part of the problem is the State Department culture is still pretty secular. Most State Department diplomats are not terribly comfortable talking about religion. So one friend of mine who was formerly with the American government in a senior important position working in the Middle East said that when she would talk to Egyptian Muslims, average Egyptians, this was before the Mubarak revolution, when she would talk to them about things like words like human rights, or democracy, that they would say, oh, well, those are kind of Western concepts. We're not quite sure about that. But when she would talk to them about religious freedom and the freedom that they wanted to be able to practice their faith without state interference, they said, yes, that's exactly what we want. That's exactly what we're all about. And she realized that because they were, most Egyptians are very religious people, that this really resonated with them.
It was much more tangible of a concept.
Yeah. And this is where, even though American diplomats may mostly be secular, most of the rest of the world is pretty religious. And just as American diplomats going into other countries need to learn to speak the language of that country, well, sometimes speaking the language of that country means understanding that country's religion. And if you want to communicate with people, you have to really understand their religion. And when people in other countries feel like you understand their religion, which for most of them is the most important part of who they are and who their identity is, then they're going to be a lot more willing to talk to you about other things, and then you might understand more what are the future trends in this country, where is this place going, and how can we build good relationships with the people of this country, especially with the religious people of this country, so that American interests and that country's interests can be aligned, and we can help in our own way to shape a better future for them.
Let me leave you off with this question then. And you've been working with the Berkeley Center at Georgetown University, focusing on these big projects on religious liberty. You've had your foot in policymaking offices that have had major influence in shaping U.S. policy to this. Are you optimistic about where things are going? Do you think the folks at Berkeley Center, Tim Shaw and Thomas Farr and yourself, you're really making a difference, that people are listening, and that in the next, 5-10 years, we're going to see a pretty good shift in U.S. foreign policy and in turn a greater shift in emphasis on religious liberty around the world?
Well, we'll see. That's a great question, Tony. I think I'm of a mixed mind there. On the one hand, I think as a thought experiment, let's say the Religious Freedom Project at the Berkeley Center had never existed, then I think things would be much worse, because I do think the Religious Freedom Project has been able to build some key relationships with current influential policymakers and with other scholars, and these sort of changes take place one person at a time, and I think there's been a very positive response to the Berkeley Center's programs, and the Berkeley Center has been able to produce some really top quality products. But change takes a while, and these are not just major institutions such as the State Department and the American foreign policy community that we're trying to influence, but these are also lots and lots of individual people who have been stuck in, I think, a more secularist mindset that A, doesn't take religion too seriously, and B, regards religious freedom with some suspicion. And so overcoming those two things is a lot. But this is where, for all the complications brought by the Arab Awakening, one advantage has been it's forced policymakers to pay more attention to religion, because you just have to. You can't understand it without religion. And so that's where, when policymakers are, you know, they're all practical at the end of the day. They're going to respond to the needs and the demands being placed in their inbox every morning. And when those needs and demands are about religion and religious freedom, they're going to naturally look for what are resources available for me. And so that's where I hope that those of us working with the Religious Freedom Project at the Berkeley Center, with wonderful support, I might add, from the Templeton Foundation, that's where I hope that we can be well-positioned to meet that need.
Well, we will point people in that direction. Anybody who wants to find out more about what the Berkeley Center Religious Freedom Project is all about, we'll link to that on our website. And so we encourage you to visit them. And I have to say that it's been wonderful talking to Professor Imboden today. Will, it's been great having you on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you so much, Tony, and my thanks to you and to your great team, and especially to the Institute for the Study of Religion there at Baylor. You know, I think one of a real kindred spirit and fellow traveler with what we're trying to do with the Berkeley Center. So look forward to continuing the conversation.
Amen.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.